This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey there, Face the Nation podcast listeners. With less than a week until the November midterms, we wanted to discuss the cyber issues that election officials are facing across the country. Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan talked with Chris Krebs, who used to run the government agency that combats election misinformation and helps safeguard election infrastructure. We hope you enjoy this Face the Nation special.
Hello, good afternoon, Twitter. This is Margaret Brennan, moderator of Face the Nation on our latest Twitter space. And today I'm excited. We're joined by a friend of Face the Nation, who is also the former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Chris Krebs. He's now a partner at the Krebs Stamos Group. And you all remember him as the top U.S. official charged with safeguarding the cybersecurity of the 2020 election. And he joins us today to discuss this year's midterm elections. Chris, good to talk to you.
Hey, Margaret. Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
We are just days away now. It's kind of surprising that it's come up on us this quickly. I feel like we've been talking about the possibility of these elections and the questions around security, and now we're really staring down the date on the calendar. And I know you're sensitive to this. I know everyone in your line of work is, but in my line of work, we really only talk more about risks than successes. We don't report on planes landing safely at the airport. We report on problems. So to be fair, and just to set a baseline here, can you tell us how secure you judge our elections to be before I get into the problems?
So a couple points. I mean, first, you're right. It does come up pretty quickly on us. I remember 2020 thinking we had all the time in the world to prepare for the 2020 election. And then next thing I knew, there we were in November. And it feels kind of like the same sort of thing here with the midterms. And I have a sneaking suspicion that 2024 will jump right up on us, and maybe even races for 24 starting as soon as later next week.
Agreed.
But you know, generally speaking, and this has been my sense for quite some time, and it was reflected in an alert sent out by the FBI and CISA a few weeks ago. But the general consensus for election systems and the fact they are managed by state and local governments, it's a decentralized approach. You know, if you've seen one state election system, you've seen one state election system. I think Director Easterly said that on Face the Nation mm-hmm. this past week or somewhere else. But, you know, given the distributed nature of election infrastructure and the extensive safeguards in place, and these are just layered defenses, their security controls, their resilience measures, and there are things like the increase of paper ballots associated with the voting process that gives you the ability to go count, recount, audit, and audit, so on and so forth. that gives everyone the confidence, gives me the confidence, gave me the confidence in 2020 to say our elections were secure. But once again, you know, right now, everyone in the U.S. government, I think everyone in the cyber threat intelligence space believes that that the election is secure, that attempts to particularly attempts to manipulate the votes, a vote at scale, which means, you know, actually change the outcome of an election, would be really difficult to conduct in an undetected manner. And so I personally believe that our elections are, in fact, secure as they were in 2020. My greater concern in the run-up to 2020 is not so much the technical vulnerabilities of systems, but it's the kind of psychological vulnerability of the voting public and even non-voters, of course, but how certain angles and stories and mistakes and errors in the process that are not determinative or leading to actual risks to the conduct and outcome of an election are being, in fact, twisted as as an information operation to lead you to believe and ultimately create chaos and undermine confidence in the process.
And when you say something like that, you're thinking of what, it taking a long time to tally votes in certain precincts or states?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example of one that I've seen recently over the last couple of days. In fact, I've seen today American sitting elected officials amplifying a narrative that this is the first time all of a sudden that it takes time, days or weeks to count an election, which in fact it is always taken a long time due to the way some systems are set up. Thinking back even to the US Civil War when mail-in ballots were provided or absentee ballots were mail-in ballots really were provided to soldiers in the Civil War. And those did not show up on election day necessarily or were tabulated. It takes time to tabulate and then canvass and then audit and then certify the elections. And that's why there is such thing as a safe harbor date of December 14th. That where states have to get their certified votes in. I mean, if you think back to 2000 in Bush v. Gore, you know, in part due to litigation, but that election was not determined until December. So this is not a novel thing. It's always been the case. Now, the distinction here is that close elections are not able to be called from an unofficial basis by the media necessarily on the night of or the next day or whatever. When you have a bigger spread in the results, it is easier through projections and some of the unofficial results where the mail-in ballots may not matter from a projection perspective. And I think that's the big difference here.
Well, and in states like Pennsylvania, you can't even begin tabulating and counting votes until election day. That's the law.
Correct. And that was a big issue in 2020 with the increase in mail-in and absentee ballot opportunities in all of these states. And yet the legislation and the state legislatures did not allow accommodations where you could not even begin counting, but begin the processing of ballots, including preparing, making sure the signatures were authenticated and verified, that all the other elements were in place so that you could make it quicker to run the ballots through the tabulation process. Now, Wisconsin did make a slight adjustment, but again, you know, the legislatures in many of these states have made it actually difficult to get the official, at least the first run of the count through, as you pointed out.
Mm-hmm. And there have been sitting Republican senators who know that, who have been tweeting things that are misleading about what may be happening. I imagine we're looking at the same accounts.
Yeah, I suspect we are. And I mean, part of this is this relates to kind of an influence and propaganda piece where there's an incentive structure in place. And there's been a shift in those incentive structures over the last several years where it actually benefits elected officials and influencers and elites to push some of these narratives because it resonates with their target audience. And you know, because they've been conditioned to believe these sorts of things. And so once you get that alignment and resonance of messaging, you create this affinity and you know, increased turnout. And the challenge is that there's no real accountability measure other than at the ballot box. And back to that incentive structure piece, if the audience is expecting it and it resonates and it's rewarding, then of course there's not going to be an accountability. And then it doesn't matter because it cycles through the next news cycle anyway. Everybody's forgot, they're moved on, and something else, you know, today's outrage hits. And so we forgot what happened yesterday.
Well, we didn't forget what happened yesterday at CBS, because I'm about to bust open our list here of those who talked about the 2020 election and continue to talk about 2 years ago, even as we head into the election around the corner. You declared it was the most secure election in history, period. When we look at our CBS tally of candidates running for office right now, there are only two states in the entire country, Rhode Island and North Dakota, where an election denier is not on the ballot. Out of nearly 600 Republicans running for office, and we're talking about all levels of office here, there are 308 candidates who've raised doubts about the integrity or validity of the election. It is not disqualifying, in fact, when we look at our polling, for someone judging who to vote for. And you're saying it's actually a feature, not a bug here.
Correct. It's the incentive structures have shifted, where it's a reward across the target audience, the base. It actually is an incentive through the primary process, at a minimum, to not speak up about it. Certainly not to say it was a safe and secure, fair and free election. That would get you primary. And that you would actually have an active antibody out there in the system working to drive you out of the system. So at a minimum, you don't say anything about it. But ideally, in this alternate reality, there's an incentive for you to actually go out there and to cry. And this is not something that just kind of stopped once you got through the primary. I think what you were going at was, you have a candidate for governor in Arizona who, in fact, said it, I believe, yesterday, questioning the current sitting legitimate president's 81 million votes. And in fact, it was 81 point something. So, you know, technically she may have been correct, but I think she was alluding that the true vote was the other direction, down, not up.
Right. And one quick point,
sorry, is, and I think I mentioned this it was on 60 Minutes last week, but you know, when we talk about how safe and secure the 2020 election was, that was a consensus view. So it was not, you know, Chris Krebs, director of CISA, saying it. That was a consensus view of election officials at the state and local level. That was federal officials in the intelligence community and law enforcement community. That was the private sector. That was the body of election administration saying, based on the view of at November 12th, 2020, that it was a safe and secure election. Moreover, it was the most scrutinized election. Certainly, you know, I can't imagine there being any more attention at any prior election on the actual administration, the safety and security of the election. Mm-hmm. It was the most litigated. So prior to the election, there was, you know, eight or so major lawsuits that I think of those, maybe it was the majority of them actually were in favor of Republican litigants. And then after the election, there were 60 plus lawsuits. So it was, again, most scrutinized, most litigated. It was also the most audited. So by 2020, there were 43 states plus the District of Columbia that had some sort of post-election audit in place. So these are not just, you know, thumb in the air type assessments. These were based on practitioners. This is based on statistics. This is based on what actually happened on the ground.
Actual facts.
Yes.
So what is your concern after this election is over? Do you anticipate, it's hard to anticipate exactly what we went through would be replicated again, but does this become a feature of our political system where the losing candidate just says, I don't believe it?
I think that's probably going to be built into the political process of democracies worldwide. So not just here. I mean, even, you know, now in Israel, we have Netanyahu, you know, potentially coming back in as prime minister, apparently. Yeah. But even after his recent, his last loss, he alluded to some sort of, you know, fraud or shenanigans in the process. The expectation was Bolsonaro in Brazil would do the same thing. Now, he mm-hmm. has been relatively silent and alluding to a transfer of power. But his supporters are out there, you know, engaging in civil unrest. And it's still kind of an open question of what happens in Brazil. But you're already seeing it here in the U.S. that there is doubt cast upon the outcome of elections, unless you win, of course. If you win, right, it's perfectly fine. And there are candidates that have already suggested, and using kind of sneaky, cloaked language about future results. The Secretary of State in Arizona, candidate for the GOP, Mark Finchem, when asked about if President Biden ran in 24, and President Biden won, would he certify? Mm-hmm. And he just dismissed it out of hand as fantasy land. And so, you know, again, they're conditioning the system for an easier rejection of free and fair elections and putting a separate alternate process in place. And there are other aspects of the system itself that could undermine, I think, what we traditionally have viewed as our democratic elections. That includes a case that's in front of the Supreme Court this term, about what's known as the independent state legislature theory, which would give state legislatures the ability to actually decide how elections are decided and potentially provide alternate slate of electors, which was one of the kind of strategies post November 8th last year.
You're talking Moore versus Harper.
Yes, that's it.
We're going to talk about that with our Jan Crawford, our Supreme Court reporter, because of what you're saying, because you're already hearing noise being made about the potential of that and undermining future elections. But on this, okay, big picture, because you think about these things, are we at the point now where a lot of this false info is spread on, a lot of it's on social media, some of it's on cable, certainly, and on the news, but is social media now a form of our nation's critical infrastructure? Is that how we should think of it?
Oh, that is, that's a great question. And one that I think about, as you mentioned, kind of quite often more broadly, like what is the infrastructure of the future? What's the next generation infrastructure? We tend to think about water systems and banks and telecommunications. And I tend to think about how technology has changed, evolved, and we've adapted to it around us. And starting with things like cloud systems and cloud computing, is that a new form of infrastructure separate from information technology and telecommunications? And it, you know, the way that we communicate now and the way we share information, and I think we talked about it on Face the Nation 2 weeks ago about how so many Americans get their news directly from social media, like TikTok. And how should we be thinking about that? So critical infrastructure is a pending question, but it's certainly a established dominant form of communication and community engagement, even if it's a digital virtual engagement that's established in society. And so we need to be thinking more broadly about certainly the benefits it provides us, but also what are the potential harms? We always think about the benefits and harms of communication means, and it's no different here with social media. And in the kind of the pivot I make right now usually is we engage as community on social media. All of our adversaries are viewing these changes and these dependencies, and they see the platforms. In the last week alone, there have been reports from Twitter, Facebook, compiled up by the Election Integrity Partnership out of Stanford and University of Washington, about China and Iranian information operations targeting the midterm elections in part. And in fact, one of the campaigns out of China was actually an anti-Marco Rubio. So it's not just about targeting Democrats; it's also about targeting Republicans. Now, to the Democrat candidate point, the company Graphica, which is a social media monitoring tool company, released a report about a Russian effort recent that's kind of a revival of some of the efforts we saw in 2016 with the Internet Research Agency. They were targeting Democratic campaigns, undermining candidates in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and you know, basically the big Senate campaigns that you think about. So we're seeing, you know, between Russia, China, and Iran, they have their strategic objectives, their favorites. Sometimes that strategic objective is just chaos, but they pick sides historically, and they're leveraging their tools. Now, the one thing I think to make a to emphasize is these tend to be very low level engagement. They're not particularly successful. They're still pretty clumsy and goofy. And I think the broader qualitative measurement of how impactful social media information operations by adversaries are is a bit up for debate. But they use them. They seem to think they work because they keep using them.
Yeah, there was a group called Zignal. I think I'm saying that right. Zignal with a Z research.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It said over the past month, there were more than 360,000 mentions of voter fraud on Twitter, up 25% from 2018. Is chatter an indicator of something, or is that, you know, when you hear and see something like that, does that smell to you of a foreign operation? Does that smell to you just of, you know, the way people are talking? Or at what point does that trigger a concern for people in the government who are saying there's something out there, an entity that's really trying to persuade voters about the integrity of the election?
How do you begin to weed out? Yeah.
So
there are a couple different mechanisms, but for one, I tend to think that there's an environmental level of disinformation and activity sponsored by foreign adversaries that is just out there all the time. It is just permeated the ecosystem, and they tend to you know, really have at least a baseline level of the zeitgeist. And right now in American politics, fraud, ballot trafficking, mules, that's all part of particularly the right-wing zeitgeist that we've seen manifest over the last couple years. Now, what the foreign or the U.S. government can do, particularly through the intelligence community and some of our own cyber capabilities, is actually penetrate some of these adversaries and get a kind of an in-house look at what they're doing. In that developed understanding, can actually be a benefit to the social media platforms as they do their own notification or their own investigations and disruptions.
Go
ahead.
Are you thinking there of what happened in 2018 with those midterm races and what the U.S. government did to proactively try to shut down the Internet Research Agency, for example, out of Russia, which was spreading disinformation?
Right. That's certainly an element. And of course, we work with our international partners who have, their own insights into what's going on, just like we can develop insights and we would share with them during their elections. There is emerging this alliance of democracies when it comes to disinformation targeting our respective elections.
So are we thinking about it wrong then when we put the emphasis in our public conversation on who owns social media companies? Like, does it fall into the realm of just it's a defense strategy to take out these propaganda networks on the outside? Or should we be talking as much as we are about, for example, who owns Twitter? Elon Musk, and the fact that the second largest investor, I believe, in the company now is Prince Al-Walid bin Talal of Saudi Arabia. Or talking about the fact that TikTok is owned by a Chinese firm called ByteDance. Like, how do we start talking about
this? That's absolutely a huge element of this. And so what we have to think about more broadly is, what are the layered defenses or the various tools in the toolkit, so to speak, that we have to disrupt disinformation operations broadly, because they're not just using social media platforms. They're able to get media or their own elements into traditional media. They're able to get it into network and cable news. They're able to use online journals and alternative sources. They use pink slime media networks and their, you know, kind of unholy alliances between political parties sometimes, or at least fringe elements of the party and some of these actors. And so what we have to think about more broadly is how to educate, how to build awareness and engagement, and precondition people more to understand, you know what, I actually know how elections work. And when I hear that story I just read, or when I hear someone saying, for instance, that we used to know when elections were decided, I know that's not true, because I remember in 2000 it took till December. I know that in my state, where we have 80%, 80% of mail-in ballots, that it takes a week. And so I think it's incumbent upon election officials and administrators, and we need to support them. The U.S. Congress needs to provide additional funding and resources. They have to be out there with transparency on the process and the expectations. And Stephen Richer, the Maricopa County, Arizona recorder, is a tremendous example of excellence in election administrator transparency. So, particularly anybody in Maricopa County, Stephen is a great example and a leader. And the overall tip to everyone is if you're looking for information on elections, if you have questions and you read something on social media, if you read something elsewhere, go to your local election official, your state election official. They are going to have the best information available to you. Now, to your other question about, do we need to take a harder look at who owns these platforms? Absolutely. And I suspect what you'll see here in the U.S. is a Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. review of the Twitter acquisition, because you mentioned that second position by Saudi Arabia. There are others in that queue from the Gulf states that could lead to some sort of national security agreement restricting certain information availability. But I'd also look at, the U.S. has a significant number of dependencies from a defense industrial base and other perspective on Elon Musk properties, including SpaceX and Starlink. And it kind of goes on. So I would not be surprised if there are some in the intelligence community that are concerned about the potential leverage the Chinese government has over Elon Musk, but just purely because of manufacturing of some Tesla parts, components, vehicles.
Right, because the supply chain for electric vehicle batteries is dependent on rare earths and things that are primarily controlled by the government of China and other countries. It's amazing how everything connects, isn't it? On the question of foreign ownership, I saw that Axios story about CFIUS. That's a committee you just mentioned, saying that the head of it would favor a ban on TikTok. But it's ultimately going to be up to Congress. And I wonder if that becomes possible after these midterm races, and if we do see, as CBS is estimating, a Republican majority in the House, possibly in the Senate, is this where there should be public pressure and demand on lawmakers to take a good hard look at who owns social media?
So on TikTok, I suspect there are other means using executive powers that could be used against TikTok, but ultimately I don't anticipate a flat out ban or, saying that it's outlawed here. I suspect, again, you'd have some sort of national security agreement review process that limits the access to information or the ability to shape algorithms. But I think it's increasingly becoming apparent that media investments, social media investments, foreign government interference and influence is a true national security concern and threat. And the good news, if there is one area of bipartisanship, particularly in the technology space that I see right now, it is on the influence of China. It's, you mentioned supply chains. You mentioned rare earths supply chains dependent upon China. almost all supply chains have some sort of Chinese dependency. It's almost like there's a reason that there's global inflation, not just U.S. inflation. It's because of the aftershocks of, and the continued, frankly, zero COVID policy of China that is creating complications throughout the supply chain. So I think a lot of what's happening right now is a hard look at how do you de-risk supply chain dependencies on China, and how do you kind of nearshore or alternate sources of product.
We had your successor as the head of CISA, Jen Easterly, on Face the Nation last Sunday. And she said there is not at this point any credible threat to election infrastructure. But she also says it's an incredibly dynamic threat environment. When she says something like that, what do you think she's thinking of?
Well, just to contextualize the dynamic nature of the threat environment is that particularly in cyber, things can kind of turn on a dime. Mm-hmm. There are a few things that I'm looking at. Maybe this will give a little bit of a sense. So in the pre-election, then the day of, and then post-election, I'll be looking at things like cyber attacks, and they can come, without warning, and they may jump up on you without you seeing them coming. The second is disinformation campaigns. We've already talked about Russia, the China, the Iranian. There are these threats and intimidation to workers, election workers and voters. We've seen what's happened in Maricopa County with the Election Network USA. And there's actually an injunction against some of these folks that showed up to monitor ballot drop boxes and tactical gear. We talked about that 2 weeks ago. There's always mistakes and errors in the process. Just here in Virginia, Fairfax County. Mm-hmm. There were some mailers sent out from a contractor that were inaccurate, that had the wrong poll voting locations. And so those have been caught and corrected. But those always happen. And those sorts of claims are being used to being amplified to continue seeding doubt and undermine confidence. So people mm-hmm. have been conditioned that elections are fraudulent. Oh, look, here's more proof by this insidious underground effort to overturn our elections, when it's just election mistakes that happened before the election. It was caught, it's been corrected, or is being in the process, and there will be an investigation to ensure it doesn't happen again. There are also external disruptions that happen during elections all the time. I mean, a great example is Hurricane Ian. So Southwest Florida, a number of counties that have been devastated, Governor DeSantis has authorized alternative voting practices. That's historically... 2018, Hurricane Michael, it happened on the Panhandle, Mexico Beach, Florida. There are ways to change how you vote due to natural disasters. But on election day, there's what we call in the kind of the cyber and elections administration community, advanced persistent backhoes. And what that means is that a construction crew somewhere in the country on election day will rip up and cut a fiber line or a power line that will shut off power to an election precinct. And election administrators are used to this. They mm-hmm. have alternate mechanisms in place. They have provisional ballots if there's some sort of power dependency. So again, election administrators are natural risk managers. They have to deal with all sorts of things, from hurricanes to earthquakes to tornadoes. And yes, now in their bag of tricks is also, defending against cyber attacks.
So you're saying if you see a power outage, don't panic.
Right. And that's, right. I mean, don't panic is the best course of action in virtually every scenario, right? I mean, so this is where if we took a little bit more time to process what's being served up to us and presented us. And if something really resonates with you or causes fear or some other sort of really strong emotional reaction, it's not a bad thing to just pause for a moment and say, wait a second, why am I reacting to this so strongly? Maybe I shouldn't listen to this random string of numbers account on Twitter. And instead, let me go check with my election official. Let me go check their website and see what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, you know what? Things are still going, or you can switch. But again, your best course of action is just to slow it down. Everybody have a little bit of patience, and we will get and get information from an election official.
And what are your biggest concerns after November the 8th, as these ballots are still being counted in some places? Like, do you encourage your former colleagues at your former agency to come out with a declarative statement like you did in 2020 that says this was absolutely secure, stamp of approval?
It depends on what the kind of the level of chatter is and the broader information environment. My sense at the time in 2020 was due to the a low quality of information was out there, because you have to keep, like, I've talked about this before, go back to the 2 weeks after the 2020 election. So right now, all the 2020 election, stolen election, rigged election stuff tends to be about domestic voter fraud. But back in the days immediately following the 2020 election, it was about CIA supercomputers. It was about thermostats. It was about algorithms. It was all this technical mumbo jumbo that 60 plus election official or election security experts and cybersecurity officials said was incoherent. And so it was our view. It was the community's view that providing some sort of stabilizing guidance was useful at the time. So it depends on what happens after the election. I suspect, though, that state election officials will speak for themselves and talk about what they're seeing, talk about the process. But there will be, again, that ambient environmental level of disinformation around fraud. And I would particularly anticipate more claims, particularly in tight elections. And I think most of these kind of battleground state Senate elections are going to be pretty tight. And obviously there's a lot on the line there. And that's where I think you'll see a lot of claims around it's taking too long. It's because they need to figure out how many votes they need to inject into the system, or, you know, figure out the mule count and all that. So
false info.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of amplification and conjecture and just flat out nonsense that's meant to undermine process and kind of explain away wins or losses.
Yeah. Well, Chris, we're going to talk again on Sunday. So thank you very much for joining me for this Twitter chat, Twitter Spaces. We're going to have you on Face the Nation on Sunday, 10:30 a.m. Eastern. And Chris Krebs will join us for more insight in election security and disinformation and what to look for and how to protect yourself. Until next time, thank you all for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene,
there were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds, but none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, Why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary and it's not boring. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. I'm going to be your financial coach, someone who brings common sense and an insider's perspective on how to manage your money and your emotions. And I promise we are going to have a little bit of fun along the way. Have a question from retirement to career changes to college funding? Just send us an email at askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.